This episode brought to you by Healthier You.
Are you living the healthiest version of you? Hi, this is registered dietitian and Run Disney race announcer Carissa Galloway, and I'm excited to share some information about the course I created. It's called Healthier You. In my talking and working with runners, they're always asking about ways to improve their health, nutrition, and for weight loss. I took everything I've learned as a registered dietitian and made it into this easy-to-navigate 12-week course. You're getting meal plans, you're getting nutrition education, you're getting recipes, and you're getting live monthly Q&A sessions with me where you can ask your personalized questions. We've had over 200 Healthier You participants this year, and so many of them are sharing great stories of success with how simple it is to use the program and how it's made huge improvements in their energy and nutrition choices. I'd love for you to join Healthier You, and you can use the code Jeff, J-E-F-F, to save $175. You can go to GallowayCourse.com or find the link in the show notes and follow me on Instagram for more information at Carissa_G-Way.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the You Can Do It podcast with Olympian Jeff Galloway. We're here to bring you motivation, inspiration, and information through the physical and mental benefits of running and walking. Today, the podcast is brought to you by Fidipides, America's first running and walking specialty store. Visit Fidipides online for running shoes, accessories, and more at Fidipides.com and use promo code JFG2020 at checkout for a limited time offer. Check out JeffGalloway.com for information on virtual training programs, retreat dates and info, and upcoming classes taught by Jeff and his staff. Today on the show, Jeff continues his journey towards the Olympic trials and talks about his most important race of his running career. Run it the stage, forever young. Hello and welcome to the second episode of the You Can Do It with Olympian Jeff Galloway podcast. I want to start by shedding a little light on something that came up in some of the comments on the first episode, and that's about our intro and outro music. So welcome, Jeff, and could you tell us a little bit about this song?
Well, Weston, this was actually a little something that put together as part of my birthday present for my 75th this year. And actually, I wasn't part of the actual putting together of it, but it was my birthday present. It was absolutely wonderful. I've been a Bob Dylan fan forever, and the song Forever Young was actually the song that we had at our wedding when Barb and I got married. The lyrics changed to document some of my life's milestones, and it was sung by the very talented John Pelkey. You might know him as one of the key announcers at the Run Disney series, along with many other things. He's an actor and very talented person, but a very good friend of ours.
Yes, a man of many talents. We'll make that available on the podcast page of JeffGalloway.com soon. So let's get you back to the story. But first, what were you thinking about on your run today, Jeff?
About how running can bestow a sense of hope, which it has done for me for over 60 years of running now. And boy, do we need hope now.
Definitely. So talking about hope, or maybe lack thereof, you started out as an overweight, lazy 13-year-old and made it to the Olympics. That's got to give hope to kids who don't show much talent in running early on, or maybe even for adults who want to become fit but are scared to take that first step. So please tell us a little bit more about your journey leading up to the 72 Olympics.
I'd love to. As you know, I love telling stories, and especially this one. The takeaway from my journey to the Olympics is that, first of all, it was very much unexpected. And secondly, you should never give up, regardless of how improbable your goal might be.
Well, that is some great advice. So we left off in the last episode when you were getting out of the Navy. You started your running career again with setting some lofty goals, but you did end up winning Peachtree. And you met some guys there and decided to become a charter member of the Florida Track Club. But instead of joining them in Gainesville, you moved to Tallahassee. And similar to my experience when I was choosing a college or a track and field team, you landed there in Tallahassee where there was a great group of friendly guys to train with.
Yes, as in most of my experiences in competitive running, it was the group of runners that was really the best part of it, the bonding and the helping one another. And in some cases, the challenges of another person that brought out the best in you. The FTC, the Florida Track Club, was centered in Gainesville, and there weren't very many postgraduate running clubs, and none of any consequence in the southern part of the United States. But this one just started, and it was headquartered out of the University of Florida. The initiator was Olympian Jack Batchelor, who was a U.S. Olympian in the Mexico City Olympics. And the second member of the FTC was a guy that I had run with in college several times, and that's Frank Shorter. These two guys were ranked in the top four distance runners year to year for several years. And if you looked at my time at the time, I would have been ranked barely in the top 200. But it was so great to be associated with people that good.
So obviously you needed to get in better shape. What did you do to change your training?
First of all, I knew that I had to increase my mileage. Having just come out of the Navy, I had spent several months gradually just getting back into shape. And I built my mileage up to 10 miles a day, which was enough to do well in the 10K, as was evidenced by my win at the Peachtree Road Race. But there weren't many really competitive runners at that first year in 1970 at Peachtree. And I knew that if I really wanted to take the next step up, I needed to increase my mileage. And the target was 20 miles a day. That was what Frank and Jack were doing. And so I set my goals every 4 to 6 months to go up another 3 to 5 miles. And sure enough, by the end of that first year, I was running 20 miles a day. I modified my once a week speed workout to include more repetitions with very little rest between. For example, I would regularly run 30 to 40 quarter miles with a 100-yard jog in between.
If you were to take a step back and do this all over again, do you think you would have that same goal of 20 miles a day, knowing what you know now, and do those kind of same workouts, or would it be a little bit different?
It's a good question, and the answer is I would change it up. I'm totally convinced that 20 miles every single day for week after week, month after month, produced a staleness, whereas if you had some differences in mileage, you backed off 1 week, and then you could push ahead another week. I think dynamically, that's so much better for the muscles as well as the ability to build in a little bit more rest.
Probably mentally too.
Oh, mentally is really true, because when you're faced with having to get in 20 miles a day, which I really felt that I needed to do to get up to that level, and you know, it gets to a point at some point in the journey when you wake up and say, oh my gosh, 10 miles this morning, and you go out and do it. But it can be a grind too.
So down in at Florida State, taking on a master's program and training for the Olympics kind of all at once, what was your mindset?
You have to look at priorities, and my number one priority was to really get serious with my training, but right behind it was obviously my master's degree program. I was in a series of classes, at least during the first 6 months, that were not overly challenging. So I was really able to spend my time getting into shape. And quite honestly, the studies and the workload that I had at Wesleyan was much, much harder than it was during my master's at Florida State. So I really had, this was a great benefit to me, because I was able to not have to spend the great hours, great number of hours that I did at Wesleyan. So I realized that when I looked at the amount of improvement, I was going to need 4 minutes of time improvement in the 10K and a little over 10 minutes in the marathon. 2 years out, so I set up a series of 4 6-month seasons, and I gave myself goals for each one of those. I truly believe that I could improve enough in one of these events, either the 10K or the marathon. But I must admit that I had no confidence that I would make it all the way to Munich. I was even then thinking that the following Olympics in Montreal might be my time. And that was okay. I was looking forward to becoming totally focused on my training and my studies, and there really wasn't time for anything else, including social life.
So was this your aspiration to really make a career out of running?
No, there wasn't any hope of doing that. There was no running industry, and no one that had been a distance runner was able to make that their career for more than just their competitive years. And it was actually not allowed, because the if you wanted to compete in the Olympics, you had to follow the amateur rules, which forbade you going out and making money off of your running in any way. But it was really entrepreneurial at the time, even though there were rules against athletes taking money. It was well known that you could ask a race director for a first-class ticket and then cash it in and go the lowest price you could possibly get and make some money off that. And a lot of us were doing that at the time.
So you had to be frugal, and you had to have a little help along the way.
Yes. And one of the great things about that time is that we athletes helped one another. We told one another when there was a race opportunity that where they had a little money and so forth. Now, where the money was made at the time, and I can get into this in a later episode, was over in Europe, because there was under the table money that was provided there, and almost never did any athletes get caught taking that under the table money. But I was not in the league to even think about that type of revenue coming in. I just wanted to be the best runner that I possibly could.
Yeah, so no real running industry, no possibility of making a career from a sport. So what kept you pushing forward?
I really wanted to see what I was made of running-wise. I was willing to train for several hours every day in the Florida heat. And I knew that I had already experienced a few exhilarating race moments, like winning Peachtree. And I was meeting really interesting people, good friends, and Frank and Jack, and they were giving me advice. And so what I did to make ends meet is I took a minimum wage job at a sandwich shop. And the main thing that I did in terms of getting into running that turned things in the right direction was learning how to enjoy workouts that left you exhausted. That it's a hard thing for people to understand, but there is a joy in being able to ride that fine line between feeling really strong and getting exhausted and hitting the wall. And I really got into that journey.
Yeah, you mentioned when you were in the Navy, you had experiences with so many people thinking that they left something on the table, or if they only could have gone back and done it again. Is this kind of also playing in your head?
Almost every night on those midnight watches, somebody would come up with that. And I wanted to be able to say, I gave it a shot. It was my shot, and I was going to do it. And if it didn't turn out right, I was fine with that. I continued to be self-coached, and I also gladly accepted the adversities, with the primary goal of being the best that I could be.
All right, so let's fast forward to the spring of 1972. How was the progressing going?
I had improved my marathon time by February 72. I was getting close. I was about 3 minutes off the standard required for getting in the Olympic trials, and I really felt that with the right weather, I would be able to do that. And out of the blue, the race director of the Inter-Service Marathon Championships gave me a call. Now, this was a race for the members of the armed services that was held every 4 years leading up to the Olympic trials. And it was designed to give members of the armed forces a chance to have a shot at getting into the Olympic trials. So this one was being held at Eglin Air Force Base, which was a 2-hour drive from Tallahassee. And I was given a place to stay, and I was allowed to run because I was at that time a Naval Reserve officer still. The benefit in the Inter-Service Championship, a unique situation in the Olympic trials, and that is that the winner of the Inter-Service Championship in the marathon would be seated directly into the Olympic trials regardless of the race time. And it turned out that it was a fabulous day for the marathon. It was cool. It was in the started out in the 40s, got up into the 50s, ideal running weather. And the last 11 miles, it had a tailwind between 20 and 30 knots to my back. And I not only ran faster than the Olympic trial standard, I ran below 2 hours and 20 minutes for the first time and qualified for travel expenses to Eugene. So when you're on a tight budget like that, that was a very big deal. And so after winning that race and qualifying for the Olympic trials, my top priority shifted to the marathon, but I still wanted to qualify for the 10K. I was a minute and a half away from that, which is a good, pretty good ways at that time.
How was the competition in that race? Was anybody near you?
No. I moved ahead of the other athletes during the first 3 miles, and there was never anybody very close. So I was totally running against the clock, and I was behind the race standard for the first 11 miles because that first 11 miles had a headwind. And then the race turned direction. It was a crosswind. I picked up and got up right near the Olympic trials standard by the time I turned and got that tailwind. And I'll tell you, I've never experienced anything like that. It was fabulous.
Is this? Did you have a obviously no GPS, so you didn't exactly know, you know, how pacing was going. Did you have a wristwatch, or was there a clock somewhere? How'd you know?
I had a wristwatch, and they had some officials about every 5 miles on the course, and so I really did have some guidance from the officials.
So April of 72 was an exciting but quite busy time for you. What else was going on?
I had just completed my master's degree, and I had to get a job. And I knew I had looked around in Tallahassee, but there really wasn't anything to my liking teaching wise. And then a friend of mine in North Carolina told me that there was a job open in a prep school, private school in Raleigh, which was my birth city, but it also is where my grandmother lived. And I hadn't seen her in a number of years, hardly at all. So I applied for that job and had to go up and do an interview. And I didn't know whether I would get that or not, but all that was going on. Plus, I had to pack up all my belongings and bring those up to my parents' house in Atlanta. Now, at the same time, my friend Frank Shorter contacted me because he had secured affordable housing in Vail, Colorado, for high altitude training, and he offered the opportunity to anybody in the Florida Track Club to train up there for 2 months. I was the only one other than Jack Batchelor who took him up on that. I don't know why, but I gladly did that. But I had another item right before that. I had registered for the Boston Marathon, and I wanted to run it. So I drove my car up to Boston for the marathon. I parked my car called Mobley 3 blocks away from the finish line. You could actually do that back then and not get towed away. I took the bus to the start. I moved up through the pack, finished 7th and the 2nd American. And then I walked the 3 blocks, got in Mobley, and took off for Vail nonstop.
I'm sure your legs really appreciated that. Well, you'd just gotten 7th in one of the most prestigious marathons that is out there. So things were really starting to fall into place for you.
Yeah, you know, this long drive to Vail allowed me to think about a lot of things. And the major thought that kept going through my brain was that I had come a long way in 22 months. I mean, to finish 7th at Boston and be the 2nd American in an Olympic year was a huge deal for me. But only the top 3 finishers in the Olympic trials would compete in Munich. And there were a number of top marathoners that didn't go to Boston that year. So I was probably at the time ranked about 7th or 8th in the country after that Boston finish. But, you know, to me, it was really all about the journey. It did not matter that the odds were against me. I was finding these hidden strengths that would pull me along and allow me to do things I had never done before. And it was really quite empowering.
So you were heading to Vail to meet up with Frank and Jack. How are you guys getting along?
We were friends, and but I had not trained much with them. I trained with Frank a few times during my collegiate days, but I had never trained with Jack. And Jack was sort of like an old salt that I had met in the Navy. He had been to the Olympics. He had competed against the best in the world, and he was always giving really interesting perspective and some gossip on some of the runners with a quite unique sense of humor. Frank was actually the most focused person I had ever met, or maybe that I have ever met. He had cognitive strategies for everything, and he was prepared for anything that could happen in training and in a race. I learned a whole lot from him, and I really owe him a lot for getting me the opportunity to go to Vail and train for 2 months at altitude. But I had a very embarrassing incident during a workout early on. The temperature was in the 40s, and we were running quarter miles on the Vail golf course. There was only one golf course in Vail at the time, and there was no track. So we measured out with a surveyor's wheel, quarter mile, half mile on the golf course. Now, by the 4th or 5th repetition at that 40 degree temperature, my sinuses started draining and I needed to spit really bad at about the 300 yard mark. So I, you know, I was courteous. I moved over to the side and I let it go out off the side, only to have a strong gust of Colorado mountain wind take it up and plant it right in the middle of Frank's chest. What a way to bond with a teammate.
So I guess kind of like blood brothers, this would make you spit brothers.
Spit brothers. But absolutely. Frank's comment was, thank you.
Was there any basis at this point or at this time that training at altitude would really help you guys?
There were a few small studies, and there were actually a lot of opinions because the previous Olympics in Mexico City had been at high altitude, and a number of athletes around the world had trained at altitude and had their experiences with it one way or the other. Frank and Jack had talked to a lot of those athletes and a lot of the coaches, and they were very meticulous in sorting through the pros and the cons of doing it, and they strongly believed that it was going to be beneficial. So I really let them do the research, and then I did what they did.
So you at least had a belief that it would help you.
Absolutely. And one of the things that kept haunting me is that altitude forces you to run slower in your speed work because you just simply can't get air. And so mechanically, I was not getting the type of speed that I would really I had been benefiting from running at sea level. So there were a lot of questions when I ended my time at Vail and went to the national championships as to whether I was going to be ready.
But this definitely had some kind of a mental benefit to you.
Oh, absolutely. What I discovered is that when I wrote my book, Mental Training, I discovered a lot of research on brain circuits and how they're turned on. And there's one brain circuit that's called the belief circuit. The belief circuit is a very powerful circuit in the brain, and it is related to the placebo effect. If you truly believe from your core that something is going, that something you're doing is going to provide a good benefit, it probably will. And the way the placebo effect works on the belief circuit is the belief circuit turns on and finds resources around in your mind and body that can help make that come about. So it may not be that your belief is correct, that altitude training is going to help you. But if you believe in it, the belief circuit finds other things that it helps you run faster. And so it's really quite a powerful thing to believe in something very strongly if it's in the remote area of possibility.
So were you racing at all during these months at Vail?
I didn't race at all. And so I really didn't have any guideline as to whether the altitude was helping or would end up helping. But my last chance to qualify for the 10K in the Olympic trials was the National Track and Field Championships, the AAU, which in 72 was held in Seattle. And it was going to take place 2 weeks before the trials, right at the end of the time that I was at Vail. During my last week in Vail, I was actually on my own because my buddies, Frank Shorter and Jack Batchelor, had already left to get settled in to Eugene and Seattle for the next few weeks. I ran my farewell tour on my loops through town. It was getting quite beautiful in June, and I packed up just about all of my earthly belongings into my 63 Volvo Mobley, and I kept studying the collection of maps I had in past trips, and I calculated that my driving time to Seattle was going to be about 20 hours. I planned to wake up for my trip to Seattle at 4 a.m. and drive up to the athlete housing at the University of Washington, their dormitories there. Planning to get in about midnight the night before my 10K race, because the race wasn't held until the early afternoon. I could still get a good night's sleep and be ready to go, but that did not happen. So the question I ask you listeners, will I get my qualifying time in Seattle? Well, join me for the next episode. A new set of running experiences is about to happen to me. I'm Olympian Jeff Galloway reminding you that you can do it.
Started in the eighth grade, running with some friends of mine. Joked and told good stories, wasn't all about finishing time. He took me off to college, built my friends along the way, running. Set my sights on the games in Munich, Germany, although it was far away, running to stay forever young, forever young. Opened a store in Tallahassee, who knows? I was on the way, running to stay forever young, forever young. Started a thing called Run, Walk, Run. Although unique, it wasn't new. Well, it helped all kinds of people, young and old and slow and fast, running to stay. marathons in 7 decades. Run all over the place. And to be honest, I'm most proud of finding everyday runners their pace. To give the gift those endorphins and finish with a smile on their face. Running to stay.